content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the July 2022 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from U.S. News titled, "School Shootings Hit Highest Level on Record, Federal Data Shows." A new report from the research arm of the Education Department shows 93 school shootings during the last school year, increasing from 11 a decade ago. By Lauren Camera, June 28, 2022. More school shootings with casualties occurred during the 2020-2021 school year than in any other year since data collection began, according to a new federal report on school crime and safety. The report, published Tuesday by the National Center for Education Statistics, a research arm of the Education Department, showed a total of 93 school shootings with casualties at public and private elementary and secondary schools during the last school year, increasing from 11 a decade ago. 43 of those shootings resulted in deaths. Although the rate of non-fatal violent victimization at school for 12 to 18-year-olds was lower in 2019 than in 2009, there were more school shootings with casualties in 2021 than in any other year since data collection began in the early 2000s, increasing from 11 in 2009 to 93 in 2021, NCES Commissioner Peggy Carr said in a statement about the report, which also analyzed data collected on criminal victimization experienced by students, discipline, and security practices at K-12 schools, mental health services provided, and campus safety and security at colleges and universities. According to the report, school shootings are defined as incidents in which a gun is brandished or fired on school property. And during the coronavirus pandemic, NCES determined that school shootings also included those that happened on school property during remote instruction. Notably, the broad methodology resulted in significantly more incidents that were reported in early estimates from Education Week's school shooting tracker, which shows that 27 school shootings occurred during the 2021-2022 school year. While the lasting impact of these crime and safety issues cannot be measured in statistics alone, Carr said, these data are valuable to the efforts of our policymakers, school officials, and community members to identify and implement preventive and responsive measures. The new data, which compares incidents of school crime and safety to data collected a decade ago, also shows that cyberbullying in public schools increased significantly, with the percentage of students saying they had experienced it jumping from 8% in the 2009-2010 school year to 16% in the 2019-2020 school year. Some bright spots. The incidence of several discipline issues at public schools declined in the decade between the 2009-2010 and 2019-2020 school years, with lower prevalence of student bullying reports at 15% of students compared to 23%, lower student sexual harassment of other students at 2% compared to 3%, and lower student harassment of other students based on sexual orientation or gender identity at 2% compared to 3%. And in the higher education setting, the rate of criminal incidents on campus also declined in that same time, from 23 per 10,000 full-time students to 18.7. However, the rate of forcible sex offenses on college and university campuses increased significantly during that decade, from 1.7 per 10,000 students during the 2009-2010 school year to 8 per 10,000 students in 2019-2020. The new report comes in the wake of the school shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 children and 2 adults were killed in May. The event, the deadliest school shooting since 2012, when 20 kindergartners and 6 teachers were killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, prompted Congress last week to pass the first gun safety legislation in nearly 3 decades. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's called, "Why This Principal Won't Carry a Gun in School, Even Though She Could." This is How One of My Kids Could Get Shot by Catherine Gewertz, July 12, 2022. Amber Estes is the principal of the Shepherd School by Eagle Community Schools, a K-6 charter school in Columbus, Ohio, that opened last fall. During that 2021-2022 school year, more than 24 shootings injured or killed people at K-12 campuses across the country, reigniting debates about school safety. In response to the deadly attack in May on an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, on June 13th, signed a new law that makes it easier for teachers to carry guns in schools. Estes has a permit to carry a concealed weapon, but is opposed to educators carrying guns in school. Her interview with Education Week has been edited for length and clarity. I grew up outside of New Albany, Ohio, on a horse farm, so I grew up around guns. My extended family hunted deer, hunted turkey, they shot shotguns, bow and arrows, all of that. I also come from a law enforcement family. I have two uncles very deeply ingrained in the law enforcement community. One was a detective with the Columbus Police Department. The other was a prosecuting attorney, and he also taught police academy students. I am also a survivor of domestic violence. It was this past Christmas with a romantic partner. That served as a catalyst to push me to take the concealed carry classes. I got my permit at the end of January, but I haven't purchased a firearm yet. For me, I'm still making sure that when I do make that purchase, I am fully prepared, because it is a massive responsibility. When you shoot a firearm for the first time, you feel a kickback, and your natural inclination is that your arm goes up. Your arm jerks, and that bullet doesn't go where the target is. That's what went through my mind every single time I held a gun during my CCW, or Concealed Carry Weapon Permit training. Oh wow, so this is how, in a school situation, if a teacher had a firearm and they're trying to shoot, this is how one of my kids could get shot. Their arm's gonna jerk, it's just what's gonna happen. When you have a concealed weapon, you have to put in the hours at the range to become comfortable with shooting the firearm, to withdraw it from wherever you choose to conceal it. That takes more skill than people think. People think, oh, I'll just wear it on my hip, and I can pull it from my hip and shoot. Everything will be accurate and go off perfectly. That's not necessarily the case. Most people capable of doing that practice for many, many hours at the range. Right now, because I'm also an expectant mother, I don't have the time to go to the range to get in those practice hours. When you get pulled over by a police officer, there's a level of nervousness that exists. We've all seen the videos, we know what happens at traffic stops, and when you have a CCW and you're carrying a firearm, you have a whole different level of responsibility in communicating with that officer. If I were to be pulled over, I'd have to go through a checklist in my mind, like, okay, I've got my license, registration, proof of insurance. I also have my CCW permit to show them and be able to tell them this is where my firearm is located. You never quite know how that other person might react when they find out that there's a firearm in the vehicle, because now I become a threat. And I'm already a threat because of the color of my skin. So I'm still making sure that I'm ready for that responsibility. My training and my experience with responsible gun ownership in my family have enriched my views and solidified why I don't believe that firearms belong in schools, unless they're carried by a fully trained resource officer or police. I'm not comfortable with teachers having guns in their classrooms because there's no way they can devote the hours that it really takes to properly operate the firearm in a school where you have a lot of obstacles. You have a ton of little kids around. We all know what kids do when they panic. They scream, they cry, they run to you. They're not running to a space of safety in the classroom. They're running to the person of safety. And if you are unable to put in the hours to shoot accurately with about 20 to 32 little people holding on to you, guess what happens? You're going to potentially take the life of one of those innocent children who are just trying to seek refuge in you. There could be a situation where you may have to restrain a child because they are a danger to themselves. And if you have a firearm on your body, that could create a more dangerous situation. This next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, "The Pandemic Set Back Big Latino Gains in Education: How to Get Them Back on Track." The coronavirus fallout interrupted Latino education success that took decades to achieve amid many pre-pandemic inequities. By Suzanne Gamboa, posted July 11, 2022. San Antonio. Latino students were making significant gains in education before the pandemic hit. Now, a top national Latino organization is calling for investments and policy changes to get the students back on track. The educational success of Latino students in recent decades has included rising math and reading scores, narrowing the gap with non-Hispanic white peers. Latinos' on-time high school graduation rate rose from 71% in 2010 to 2011 to 82% in 2018 to 2019. And the number of Latinos enrolled in post-secondary education increased 384%, from 782,400 in 1990 to almost 3.8 million in 2019, according to an Unidos U.S. report released Monday. During the pandemic, math and reading scores fell among all students, but Latinos in 3rd to 8th grade saw sharper declines. The Unidos U.S. report said Latinos were more likely to attend high-poverty schools that switched to remote learning during the pandemic. Latinos make up more than one-quarter of the public school population, and nearly all, about 94%, of Latino children under 18 are U.S.-born citizens, the report said. As we emerge from the shadow of the pandemic, which we know really hit the community of Latinos very strong, our goal should be to reimagine what education can look like to ensure the success of Latinos and for the future, Amalia Chamorro, Unidos U.S. Education Policy Director, said at a news conference during an annual meeting in San Antonio. Janet Murguia, Unidos U.S. President, said in a statement that there is an urgent need and opportunity for the U.S. to correct long-standing inequities in the education system that stalled Latino students' education progress during the pandemic. Unidos U.S. recommended improvements in gathering data on student learning and enforcing compliance with federal law to identify and support lower-performing schools. This next article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, "One Small Step for Democracy in a Live Free or Die Town." A cautionary tale from Croydon, New Hampshire, where one man tried to foist a change so drastic it jolted a community out of political indifference. By Dan Berry, posted July 10th. The tiny New Hampshire town of Croydon fits the New England of the imagination, with its cozy general store, one-room schoolhouse, and local museum open by appointment. The only thing missing is supposed to be missing: a stoplight. But it's not just the Rockwellian setting that makes this community of 800 seem quintessentially American. People here have just experienced a fractious come-to-Jefferson moment that has left many with a renewed appreciation for something they had taken for granted: democracy. Showing up. That's the big lesson, said Chris Prost, 37, a Croydon resident who runs a small brewery from a barn at the back of his house. And not just showing up, but also knowing what's going on. Hope Damon, 65, a dietitian who is pursuing a new career as a result of her town's recent crisis, agreed. What happened here, she said, could happen most anywhere. To understand what happened and is happening in Croydon, you should remember the New Hampshire motto, "Live free or die." This is, after all, the only state that does not require adults to wear seatbelts. You also should know that New Hampshire's individual rights vibe, along with its small population, 1.38 million people, and large legislature, 400 representatives and 24 senators, has drawn libertarians like colonists to a tea party. This includes the Free State Project, a movement that for years has promoted a mass migration of liberty activists to the state so as to seed a kind of limited government Shangri-La. The group espouses radical personal responsibility, constitutional federalism, and peaceful resistance to shine the light on the force that is the state, its website says. Croydon, incorporated in 1763, is among the New Hampshire towns with the Free State vein running through its granite hills. This was hinted at in 2020 when Ian Underwood, a town selectman aligned with the Free State, proposed eliminating the police department as a way to fire its sole employee, the longtime and somewhat controversial chief. The three-member select board adopted the approach and instructed the chief to return his badge and gear. He promptly handed over his uniform, which he happened to be wearing, and then, in hat, boots, and underwear, walked out into a February snowstorm. His wife collected him down past the general store. Croydon life continued, with yard sales at the museum, Halloween celebrations at the fire station, and generally low turnouts at the annual town meetings, a direct democracy tradition common in New England when residents gather to approve, deny, or amend proposed municipal budgets. On a snowy Saturday this past March, the 2022 meeting began in the two-century-old town hall, where the walls are adorned with an 1876 American flag made by the women of Croydon and instructions to reset the furnace to 53 degrees before leaving. Residents approved the town budget in the morning. Then they turned in the afternoon to the proposed $1.7 million school budget, which covers the colonial-era schoolhouse, kindergarten to fourth grade, and the cost of sending older students to nearby schools of their choice, public or private. This is when Mr. Underwood, 60, stood up and threw a sucker punch to the body politic. Calling the proposed budget a ransom, he moved to cut it by more than half, to $800,000. He argued that taxes for education had climbed while student achievement had not, and that based in part on the much lower tuition for some local private schools, about $10,000 for each of the town's 80 or so students was sufficient, though well short of, say, the nearly $18,000 that public schools in nearby Newport charge for pupils from Croydon. In pamphlets he brought to the meeting, Mr. Underwood asserted that sports, music instruction, and other typical school activities were not necessary to participate intelligently in a free government, and that using taxes to pay for them, quote, crosses the boundary between public benefit and private charity. The pamphlet did not note that its author was a 1979 graduate of the public high school in Chesterton, Indiana, where he starred on the tennis team, ran track, played intramural sports, and joined extracurricular activities in math, creative writing, radio, and student government. Also, National Honor Society member, National Merit finalist, and valedictorian. One person not completely gobsmacked by Mr. Underwood's proposal was the school board chairwoman, his wife, Jody Underwood. The Underwoods, who do not have children, moved to Croydon from Pennsylvania in 2007, in part to join the Free State mission. They are now considered a Free State power couple. Dr. Underwood, 61, a learning scientist with a doctorate in education, said that she had known of her husband's budget cut proposal beforehand, but hadn't felt obliged to give the community a heads up. "Do Ian and I talk about things?" "Yes," she said. "Is that shocking?" "Even so," she said, "I didn't think it was going to pass." In fact, Mr. Underwood's motion was seconded, sparking a contentious debate that included his wife reading a statement in support of the budget cut, in effect arguing against the $1.7 million budget that she and the rest of the school board had previously recommended. Dr. Underwood later explained that her husband's assertions, including that education spending had gone up 30% in recent years, had persuaded her. Amanda Leslie, 42, a resident who teaches in another district, became so alarmed that she texted her husband to get to town hall right away. The Free Staters are trying to cut the budget more than in half. His vote wouldn't have mattered. The budget slashing amendment passed, 20-14. The school clerk, Angie Beaulieu, was so dismayed by what she had just witnessed that instead of signing her account of the minutes with the standard respectfully submitted, she wrote, "Regretfully submitted." The shocking budget cut meant that the school board suddenly had to craft a new financial plan, while many parents suddenly had to come up with thousands of dollars to keep their children in public schools. I would have had to put in an extra 1,000 hours of work a year, said Ed Spiker, 38, a painting contractor whose two sons attended Newport Public Schools. Mr. Underwood did not respond to requests for comment, but in the weeks after the meeting, he and his wife made separate appearances on an online Free State program to discuss what Free Staters were claiming as a victory for their cause. Mr. Underwood asked what for him appears to be a fundamental question. Why is that guy paying for that guy's kids to be educated? And denied that he and his wife were in cahoots. It's a lot of stress on her at home, said Mr. Underwood, who has described himself as a former planetary scientist and artificial intelligence researcher. Less stress on me. I just threw the wrench into the machinery, and now, you know, the school board has to clean it up. Dr. Underwood, meanwhile, smiled as she recalled the amendment's passage. She also noted that, quote, people were pissed. For students taking debate, as Mr. Underwood did in high school, this is an example of understatement. Many Croydon residents were livid, but they were also chastened. They hadn't attended the town meeting. They hadn't fulfilled their democratic obligation. They hadn't kept informed about the Free State movement. To some observers, they had gotten what they deserved. I was practically kicking myself in the ass for not being there, Mr. Spiker said. I guess I assumed our town would take care of it. The moment revealed a democracy mired in indifference. Turnout at town meetings has been low for years. The town's websites are barely rudimentary, with school board minutes posted online sporadically. The select board minutes are found at the town hall, open 3 afternoons a week, or the general store, beside chocolate bars being sold to benefit the local humane society. From this muddle of anger, confusion, and regret, though, a movement was born. It came to be known as We Stand Up for Croydon Students. Conservatives, liberals, and those who shun labels, an entirely nonpartisan group, said Miss Damon, one of the members, began meeting online and in living rooms to undo what they considered a devastating mistake. They researched right-to-know laws, sought advice from nonprofits, and contacted the state attorney general's office to see whether they had any legal options. They did. Under New Hampshire law, citizens could petition for a special meeting where the budget cut could be overturned if at least half the town's voters were present and cast ballots. Miss Beaulieu, 44, a project manager for a kitchen and bath store, helped to gather enough signatures for the necessary petition. Once a date in May was set for the special meeting, she and other volunteers spread the word, knocking on doors, conducting phone banks, and planting lawn signs. Meanwhile, the 3-member school board developed a plan to fit with its shrunken budget. It would mean that more than half the jobs in the town's tiny school system would be either lost or outsourced. For the lower grades, a private contractor would provide in-person learning at the schoolhouse that included a certified teacher overseeing 3 so-called guides, who needn't be certified. For the higher grades, $9,000 allocated for each student would cover the cost of nearby private schools or an in-person online option. In a church, or town hall, or some rented space, Dr. Underwood said, but only about half the tuition for public schools. Democracy is a scrum, especially in a town of 800. There were awkward encounters at the Shaw supermarket in Newport, cross accusations of bullying and misinformation, sharp words exchanged on Facebook and at town meetings. Some neighbors stopped taking long walks together. There also developed a heightened awareness, and for some, a heightened distrust of the Free State movement. Aaron McKeon, 39, a school board member whose children were already being taught at home, said that the We Stand Up supporters didn't waste any time starting a Free State witch hunt. In fact, he said, they inaccurately described him as a Free Stater because his position sometimes aligned with those of the Underwoods, though he believed that Mr. Underwood's sudden and divisive motion to cut the budget was not the best approach. I agree with some of the things they try to do, Mr. McKeon said of Free Staters, but that doesn't make me one of them. I don't believe it for a second, said Miss Leslie, the teacher. The crisis in Croydon generated a curious democratic dynamic. Since the law required that at least half the town's electorate participate in the special meeting's vote for it to be binding, those trying to overturn the Underwood budget encouraged people to attend, while those hoping to retain it encouraged people to do just the opposite and stay home. On the chilly Saturday morning of May 7th, Croydon residents filed into a spacious building at the local YMCA camp for their special meeting. The We Stand Up contingent needed at least 283 voters. and we'll have to cut that article short for time.
And here are the top lines of a few articles.
From U.S. News, Education Department approves $8 billion in public service loan forgiveness. The 2008 Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program had been mired by complicated eligibility rules and servicing errors that made it nearly impossible to benefit from until a Biden administration overhaul, by Lauren Camera, posted June 27th. The Education Department has approved $8.1 billion in student loan debt cancellation for nearly 1,450,000 borrowers in the 9 months since the Biden administration overhauled the failed Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. The new figure marks significant progress the department has made since announcing major changes to the program in October 2021, one of the several actions taken by Education Secretary Miguel Cardona aimed at canceling student loan debt for certain borrowers trapped in dysfunctional repayment plans due to misguided technical rules and mismanagement by loan servicers or for borrowers defrauded by for-profit school colleges. The next article comes from Education Week. It's titled, Revamped Florida Civics Education Aims for, quote, patriotism. Will it catch on elsewhere? By Ileana Najaro, posted July 12, 2022. For years, Florida has been cited as an exemplar when it comes to investing in access to K-12 civics education. In the 2010s, it boosted civics coursework and related tests and inspired other states to do the same. Now, the state's approach to civics is evolving in a new direction, towards an overtly patriotic approach that some educators say is imbued with Christian and conservative tenets. And all of that is occurring as Florida's law-limiting classroom discussions on race, a key theme in social studies, takes effect. And the final article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, For Uvalde Families, A Call for Answers Grows Louder. At city council meetings and at a protest on Sunday, the relatives of the slain children and teachers have shown their anger and frustration. By Edgar Sandoval, posted July 11th. Kimberly Rubio and her husband Felix took the stage on Sunday evening at Uvalde Plaza next to City Hall while holding a photo of their slain daughter, Alexandria Ania Rubio, known as Lexi, and read aloud part of the mission statement of the Uvalde Police Department. The department is, quote, committed to providing superior police service to the public in order to protect life, Ms. Rubio said, her voice quavering. She recalled testifying before Congress to plead for more gun control measures in the aftermath of the mass shooting in her city. Then she looked up and gained fire in her voice. What I want, no one can give me, she said. I want my daughter back. If I can't have her, then those who failed her will never know peace. Run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.